Hey, welcome along. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time. That means it's 5 p.m. in the Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 p.m. in beautiful Newfoundland and Labrador, 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 10 p.m. in Western Europe, 11 p.m. Cairo and Jerusalem, midnight in Moscow, and it's the early hours of Saturday morning, the weekend proper for our listeners throughout Asia and the Pacific. And wherever you are, we bid you welcome to another of our Clubland Q&As. You know how this works. Wherever you are on the planet, you can listen to this show. If you want to ask a question, you've got to be a Mark Stein Club member. And if you're a brand new Mark Stein Club member, we'll make an extra effort to try and get to your question in the course of today's show. Wherever you are on the planet, you've got to be having better weather than we have here in northern New England, because we've had 20 inches of snow. It's whiteout conditions driving around, and even if there was not, I say this on the eve of the New Hampshire primary, because to any of you reporters who get to sit with Bernie on his private plane and fly around, I don't know why anyone needs a private plane to fly around New Hampshire. It's not that big a state. But anyway, if you're flying around with Bernie on his Learjet or whatever he's upgraded to now, you might want to ask him about this. Even if there was no Connecticut River, you could still tell the difference between New Hampshire and Vermont, because on the New Hampshire side, they have this thing called a highway department, which is apparently an innovation no one has introduced to the state of Vermont yet. You know, my friend Nigel Farage had great success in the European elections with the Brexit Party, which was a single-issue party. It only had one policy, Brexit. And so it took no position on tax policy or education or healthcare or foreign policy or anything like that. It just had one thing, Brexit, single-issue party. And I'm thinking of founding a single-issue party in Vermont called the Snowplow Party. It would have no other policies. It would have no position on healthcare or taxes or anything like that. But it would be it would have the great innovative policy of introducing the snowplow to the state of Vermont, where it apparently if they ever had the species in Vermont, it's extinct. So I feel liberals, the three conservatives in Vermont, the transgendered, we can all get behind the Snowplow Party, which I may be launching in Vermont after my drive from New Hampshire to the studio today. At any rate, welcome. We're not going to talk about that for the full hour. We'll maybe talk about it for the next 45 minutes, but we might get to all the other stuff too. As you know, it has been a roller coaster of a week. What with the abysmal fiasco of the Iowa caucus, which I still believe, I think at the time of, no one still knows who won it. So we're all already into doing, Tuesday is New Hampshire primary day. I don't know whether we're going to actually get 100% of the Iowa caucus vote total by then. But as the old joke has it, if Bernie manages to win New Hampshire, that'll give him the big momentum going into the Iowa caucus, because they're now saying we've got to rerun the whole thing. There's that. Then there was the State of the Union, and then there was the final end of the impeachment, another fiasco for the Democrats. And then there was Trump's reaction to it the following day at the National Prayer Breakfast and all the rest of it. And it's also been a roller coaster of the week. As you know, for me, I had actually one of the trickier hosting assignments I've ever had in my many years in broadcasting, when Rush bade farewell on Monday by announcing that he had advanced lung cancer. And then tossed the baton to me to guest host on Tuesday and Wednesday. It wasn't the easiest thing to do. You get a bit of everything in the course of a week when you're at Rush's level of life. So shortly after announcing that he had advanced lung cancer, the following night, the president brought him to the State of the Union and surprised him by giving him the Presidential Medal of Freedom. All that has been, so it's been quite a week. We'll also attend to any other matters overseas that you wish to get to. Let's get to it. Greg Elliston writes, President Trump just took out Al-Qaeda bigwig Qasem al-Rimi in Yemen. Boom! Has the mainstream media figured out an appropriately deferential way to refer to the late Mr. al-Rimi? Was he an austere scholar, a technological wonder, devoted soldier? Will the Democrats be forced into defending him because of their Trump derangement syndrome? Seems like a perfect way for President Trump to have ended this incredible week. As you know, they came to the defense of, what was the guy? Baghdadi, the caliph, the wannabe caliph, the caliph who wasn't, the caliph who got kiboshed. That was President Trump took the caliph out, Baghdadi, and he was described by the media as a revered Islamic scholar. All the time he was building his caliphate, we were told that ISIS had nothing to do with Islam. And then when the guy winds up dead and pushing up virgins, we're told all of a sudden he's the revered Islamic scholar. Then they get this guy, General Soleimani, and Chris Matthews compares his death to the death of Princess Diana as a death that has convulsed the world. So, I don't know, this Qasem al, whether this is this Qasem al-Rimi, and maybe he's like the maybe he'll be Elvis to Chris Matthews or Judy Garland or Amy Winehouse. The trick with these things, why Trump is good at this, you know, the fact of the matter is they are going to, because they're opposed to anything Trump does, they'll be opposed to him droning Qasem al-Rimi in Yemen. And the trick with all these things for a savvy politician is to anticipate your opponent's reaction. Trump did something profoundly moving. You know, Soleimani and Baghdadi, the Democrats can pretend they're actual house-trained persons worthy of humanitarian respect in the way that Nancy Pelosi, as you know, objected to Trump characterizing the MS-13 gang members as animals. These guys actually were animals. They were killers. They were in the killing business. And they killed very effectively. And they thought of particularly brutal and effective ways to kill people. And so the president of the State of the Union, when he introduced a victim of Baghdadi and the families of the victims of Baghdadi and the victims of Soleimani, it was actually a moving moment. It reminded you of what these guys did. Killing was their business. And the test was this. The test was this. Could Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats rise above their loathing of Trump to salute these victims of Soleimani and Baghdadi? And Nancy Pelosi and 90% of the Democrats couldn't. There were one or two isolated people who stood during Trump's speech. I noticed my own senator, not someone I'm particularly partial to, Jean Shaheen, a Democrat, but she did stand, she was up and down more than any of the white maidens in the AOC squad were. So head faking your opponent into looking as bad as the Democrats did on Tuesday night is quite remarkable. Tara Johnson writes, oh, I love the name Tara. Tara, such a lovely Irish name. And you know something, I don't find, there's not enough characters in books and movies and things these days called Tara. Tara, there was Tara King in The Avengers, played by my great compatriot, Miss Linda Thorson, after Diana Rigliffe. We're getting a bit detoured here. Anyway, Tara Johnson, lovely name. Tara writes, hi, Mark, it's my first time asking a question. And that is, how is everyone still letting the CNN Facebook types dictate the narrative? From being constantly shocked by results the rest of us can see straight ahead to obviously interfering on behalf of Hillary last time, and trying to oust Bernie again. The Warren accusing him of saying a woman couldn't be president seemed entirely an attempt to get Bernie on a hot mic, saying something to the effect of, you know what I meant by that, and then destroy him as a liar. Why else would CNN have the mic still on, release it within an hour of the debate, and with Warren sounding like she had been nervously rehearsing the line all week? Bingo, Tara, you're absolutely right. If you think CNN, nothing is accidental. If you think CNN left that mic on by accident, no. They wanted to get Bernie saying something mean. But as usual, of course, it didn't work. I remember when I first joined the club, listening to a panel on media and social media, lamenting that the right had spent a lot of time blogging instead of creating platforms like Facebook, YouTube. But it was as if the time for that had come and gone. I think new platforms are still on the table. Is there a way we can encourage development in this way from the right to help reshape the narrative? There's really two questions in there, Tara. That show you refer to was a kind of, I think it was a free speech edition of the Mark Steyn show. And that's Kathy Schadl's thing. There's actually not that as much content that the right creates as it should be, because we've got all these websites. You know, they're always starting these websites, you know, patriot.com, eaglepatriot.com, eaglepatriotoldglory.com, that are just like aggregating the same 10 things from everywhere else. We've spent too much time creating these websites and not enough, for which there isn't actually that much need these days, and not enough time creating a thing of its own, like Twitter or Facebook. And Kathy was right about that. But the point you make is actually more about basic interference. I said, you know, I got sick of the sophisticated analogies and just said that basically the Democrats and the media are now just like Yosemite Sam. They keep sticking the dynamite down their own pants, and then it blows up in their face. And then that's what Nancy Pelosi, she was literally stomping around like Yosemite Sam the other night at the State of the Union. None of it works. I mean, you'd have to be an idiot to think that Bernie, by all accounts, from the Bernie bros are misogynists, according to all the accounts of the last campaign. There was a lot of misogyny and sexism in the Bernie Sanders campaign. So there is an element of truth to the fact that in Bernie world, there's a degree of sexism and misogyny. But oddly enough, whenever Elizabeth Warren accuses you of something, it blows up in Elizabeth Warren's face and it doesn't work, because Elizabeth Warren is a liar and nobody cares about anything she said. So that didn't work. That didn't work for her. None of it's working for them. None of it's working for them right at the moment. You know, somebody was talking around about the time of the impeachment thing. The week's gone so fast, but in the course of it, I think Tuesday or Wednesday, someone was saying to me, you know, there are competing narratives. So there's the Trump narrative, and then there's the hate Trump narrative, the Democrats and the media. It's not actually quite like that, because nothing. Trump wins. Trump won on impeachment. The only thing that happened for the 3 months or whatever it is that they've been impeaching this guy is that his numbers went up from 35% to 49%. The Republican Party's numbers went up to the highest level in 15 years since the sort of high watermark of the kind of Bush post 9/11 stuff. And Joe Biden turns out to be the only guy fatally damaged by impeachment. Because oddly enough, even if you deny it, by simply having Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler going on TV all the time and saying there's no legitimate reason to call Hunter Biden or Joe Biden as a witness, nevertheless, just winds up making an odor of something not terribly pleasant hanging over the Biden campaign. I mean, the Biden campaign's useless anyway. But basically, impeachment delivered the coup de grace to him. Nothing's working for them at the moment. And it's fascinating because this elections, it's like Trump did in those Michigan, Pennsylvania, you know, where you have to persuade a few thousand people in swing states who last time round voted for the other guy, this time round to vote for you. And you don't do that by embarking on this bizarre, weird obsession. They're basically nuisance litigants. The left, and I say this as someone who was sued by that wanker Carrie Katz year in, year out for years, and has had this, you know, so I had that for 3 years. It consumes a lot of time. But once you get the measure of a nuisance litigant, you just know he's going to lose all the time. Of course, he's an idiot and he wants to spend millions of dollars proving that he's a loser. But in the American system, you can't do a lot about that. And basically, Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler and Nancy Pelosi are nuisance litigants. They basically sued Trump over Russia, and that went nowhere. Then they tried Stormy Daniels, and that went. That was a campaign infraction. You know, it's like what a country. You can't even have a decent sex scandal. You know, when the Tories had sex scandals, the autoerotic asphyxiation scandal was at least about autoerotic asphyxiation. The family values guy who was sharing a bed in France with another man, at least that was about a family values guy sharing a bed in France with another man. The Secretary of State for Wales, who was cottaging for a bit of rough trade on Clapham Common, at least that was about gay sex. You got no sex in a sex scandal here. Trump's thing with Stormy Daniels, it's supposed to be a campaign finance scandal. That went nowhere. So then the nuisance litigants turned to Ukraine. That's gone nowhere. They're nuisance litigants. They're like these nutty, self-represented plaintiffs that you can see in county court any time of the day. The guy who won't accept that the divorce is over, the guy who won't accept that he's been fired from his job, the guy who won't accept that the lease on his apartment was legitimately terminated. And so he keeps suing his ex-wife. He keeps suing his former employer. He keeps suing his former landlord. Just finds another excuse, another excuse, another excuse, go back. That's basically what the Democrats are with Trump. They're nuisance litigants. And the thing is, because it's politics, and most of this political flim-flam is even loosey-gooseier than it is down at the county courthouse, they can keep doing that. But they're nuisance litigants. And when they come up with the next impeachment thing, which they'll be doing a day after Trump wins re-election in November, they'll be back to the nuisance litigation all over again. Brian Heiler writes, "Hi, Mark. New member today." Well, congratulations, Brian. It's a thrill to have you with us. Brian is from, let me have a look at this, I think from the Virginia area. It's not an area, it's a state, it's a commonwealth. So don't take offense at me calling it an area. And Brian, it's your first day. Do prowl around, see what you like. We've got Tales for Our Time, a big archive of cracking audio fiction, and we've got our video poems, and we've got our music archive, and we've got all these editions of the Mark Stein Show, like the one that Tara just mentioned, our free speech forum with Kathy Shadle and Tal Bankman and Andrew Lawton talking free speech issues. So do have a good, have a fun time prowling around and seeing what you like and what you don't like. And if you don't like it, let us know and we'll try and come up with some stuff you do like. Anyway, Brian says, "I have a couple of questions for you. You are such a great speaker and have great comedic timing. Can you relate a time where your material did not work and how you handled it? Also, love to know the first time you said or wrote something that got blowback from the mainstream and how that experience affected you." Actually, they're interesting questions. You know, the funny thing, I think when I was 18, I was in Toronto and I rather ill-advisedly agreed to do a stand-up thing, stand-up gig south of the border in Buffalo. and it was a disaster. And I was as I bombed, I was as humiliated as I've ever been. And I was to the point where, what was that? I was 18 years old. I didn't set foot on stage again for another 60 years. That's how traumatic it was. And I'd learned something from that, and I think back on it from time to time. And one of the interesting things, I thought I had some pretty funny lines, and doubtless I've recycled a few of them over the years, hither and yon. I didn't understand that before, which is, I think, essential, before an audience will laugh with you, before they like your material, they have to like you. And it's actually, that's perhaps the most important decision anyone makes whenever they step out on stage. And actually, I think about things like that, and I think about, these days, you say when material doesn't work or whatever, I have lines that I use if I'm on stage that I like, and I like them enough that if only three other people laugh, I'm never actually terribly bothered by it. I'm still fond of those lines. And so I keep using them, and if one day seven people laugh at them instead of three, I'm happier. And if 33 people laugh at them, I'm happier still. But I think it takes you a long time to have that kind of confidence. And there's a sort of nervousness that attends to comedy, that you think you have to throw it in there. And I always think the most important decision you make, I often think when you walk out, you can do two things. You can get a laugh on the first thing you say, or you can just think, yeah, I'm just going to wait, hold off. You see this in funny plays too. Sometimes if you hold off on the first funny line, the longer you hold off, the bigger the laughs that will, if you delay the first laugh, the laughs that come will be bigger and funnier. And that's one thing I think about a lot over the years, and actually has worked. And I always, that's the great thing, the panic that people have, that they think somehow, they think energy is to do with speed and frenzy, and they think pace is to do with speed and frenzy. And it isn't. You can walk out and stand perfectly still and have comedic energy in there. I'll give you an example. There was a guy, he actually was the sort of opening act for me when I was in Toronto a few years back. I'll spare his blushes by mentioning his name. But he opened, and he was talking about his book, and it was a fairly serious thing. He's a fairly serious guy. He was a respected guy then, not quite so respected now. But then I came out and I did my shtick. And we had a little finale, and the finale was a sort of comic song. And I thought, oh, well, I ought to give the opening act something to do. I ought to give him a line in here because he ought to be part of the finale. We ought to give him something to do. So I gave him a funny, he was supposed to walk on stage and interrupt the number in a funny way. And I gave him one line. But before he said the line, I said, just walk out there, stand rather petulantly with your hands on your hips. I said, and just stand there. Don't say anything. If you want, you can count to 15 before you deliver the line. And don't worry about the silence. It'll get a huge laugh then when you do the line. And of course, we come to the finale of the night. I'm doing the comic song with the guy at the piano. And midway through, the other fella comes rushing out and garbles the line, and it dies. And I was furious with him. And for years afterwards, I'd like have random dreams of this guy blowing his line because he didn't have the confidence to just walk out on stage and stand there and make the audience adjust to his timing. And that's the thing. And I won't mention the guy's name. He was like a conservative guy then, and he's now gone completely the other way. He was a climate change skeptic. Now he's hot for the climate, for the climate change. He was pro-Catholic. Now he's anti-Catholic. He was very anti-gay marriage. Now he thinks it should be compulsory. He's completely changed. But I think it all comes down, in fact, to him blowing that line. It does take you a long time to just have so much comedy is about pandering. And in fact, what's really comfortable is when people are really comfortable, they don't want to be pandered to. And the trick is just to relax into it. Anyway, never mind that. Love to know the first time you said or wrote something that got blowback from the mainstream. Well, you know, the odd thing was, Brian, I never ever... They didn't used to have this thing. I mean, I worked for years in Canada and the UK, both of which are super... Toronto and London are super competitive media markets. And in those days, you could pretty much write what you wanted to write. It didn't really matter what it was. You could write about, homosexuality, abortion. And people would sometimes roll their eyes, but they didn't actually try to get you fired from anything. I think I mentioned this once before. Gary Bushell from The Sun newspaper, Mr. Murdoch's great tabloid in London. I think it's the biggest selling tabloid. Well, it's certainly the biggest selling tabloid in Europe, for example. But their columnist, Gary Bushell, his solution to the AIDS pandemic, for example, was to suggest that practicing homosexuals be tattooed at the base of their spines with "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." And The Sun published that, and The Guardian readers all tutted about it and rolled their eyes, but they didn't actually try to destroy the guy over it. And the funny thing is, that is actually a phenomenon of our times. And I'm kind of relaxed about it now. I mentioned on the radio, you know, everyone was on at me because I'd said Mayor Pete didn't seem terribly gay to me. And I've had all this stuff from gays who say, yeah, you're right, what's up with that? And he's like, and the advocate in America and the gay publication in Italy and all these other gay publications, gay news in the UK all did this thing. I'm not good. You're wasting your time with me. I don't care. Cancel me. I couldn't care less. This sort of blowback. The thing is, the blowback only matters if you let it matter. And what it requires is just people not caring. I don't care. I don't care. I as I said on Rush the other day, that gay publication in Italy, I'm having it framed and stuck on the wall. It's like, when's the next time I'm going to make the front page of some gay publication in Italy? That was great. Do your worst. But it's interesting. We didn't have it back then. We didn't have it. Wayne Lanham. Right. So realize this question may be a non sequitur given the momentous events of the week. But I've neglected to ask this for months. How did you become so bloody well educated while avoiding the burden of an academic credential? I'm a firm believer in self-teaching, but even the most voracious readers will face limitations without mentoring, guidance, or coursework. And you seem to be more than 3 standard deviations beyond what is possible for typical humans. So what's the secret? Well, the secret for most things is curiosity. You know, I spoke about this in connection with Rush, I think, on Tuesday or Wednesday. Rush is an autodidact. He's one of those guys who... understood very early on, probably by about, you know, I don't know, 9th or 10th grade, that the classroom was not the place for him. And it doesn't matter because he didn't have to go to the Columbia Journalism School or go and do broadcast studies at some college, wherever, because he has curiosity. He has a great, fertile, churning, active mind. And my whole thing is that, again, we shouldn't accept the left's terms on this. Avoiding the burden of an academic credential, says Wayne, by which we think now that an academic credential is a, in America, is a bachelor's degree or a master's degree. And actually, because bachelor's degrees have been degraded by all the, transgender studies and all the rest of it, that now most you have to have the master's degree, and pretty soon you'll have to have a PhD, and pretty soon the kind of stupid half-wit candidates running around saying we need universal college will be saying we need universal PhDs. And at that point, PhD will be the equivalent of what middle school was around 1938. The more you universalize everything, the more undemanding education becomes. And I'm happy to have been perhaps among the last generation for whom it was expected that teachers at both grade school and high school would impart knowledge to you. And that's as important as anything else. The most important education you get is actually the first 8 grades. Once they screw that up, you can stay from grade 8 to grade 38, and it's not going to make any difference. The most important, if it's not in place, then it's really difficult to catch up. And I've said this before. I'm so tired by how undemanding. My kids went to the local high school in my corner of New Hampshire. It's 20 miles up the road. Actually, maybe a little further, because we didn't have a high school in town, and it was supposed to be, by the standards of the area, a good high school. But what absolutely got me with my kids was, they started in school, and they come back and you catch them sort of cutting out bits of cornflakes boxes and sticking stuff onto the cornflakes box, and you think, oh, well, that's okay. They're in kindergarten and first grade. And in fact, they're sticking things on the cornflakes box phase of public education actually never ends. It's terrible. It's so undemanding, and that's the reason. And unless people talk about university for critical thinking, no. The pillars of critical thinking have to be put in actually by grade 8, I would say. George, I always, when George's aide came up before, I think I pronounced it Pazin, and I think he says it as Pazin or Pazin. Pazin, 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 Pazin. Anyway, George says, hi, Mark, nicely done earlier in the week on Rush. I have an open line Friday question for you. What are your thoughts on Ayn Rand? Have you ever written extensively on her? I can't recall much in your books, but my memory isn't what it used to be. Which writers had an impact on you in your formative years, fiction and nonfiction? Well, you know something. She is an important, let me put it this way. She's an important person. I went to see the first, this would be about 5 or 6 years ago, the first, it was, I think it meant to be the first film in a trilogy when that came out, in the Great Rand Trilogy, and it wasn't good, and I'd gone along wanting to like it, and in the end it wasn't a great film. I don't know that the other two parts ever came out. I wanted to enthuse about it, but it made sort of plain what my problem with her as a novelist is that I don't quite buy her as someone who can breathe life into characters that then take on a life of their own. I'm not saying your mileage may vary and all the rest of it, but so I'm not, she's an important philosopher. But I'm not mad about her as a writer, and that's all I'd say on that. And as a philosopher, she's undoubtedly important, and that is enough. And the fact that the books are what they are and are massively popular and sell incredibly well and all the rest. But, I always think, particularly when you're reading a novel, you don't just want characters who are representing points of view. You want them to be able to spring to life as fully formed creatures of their own. And I try every so few years. I try again, and it doesn't actually work. When you say which writers had an impact on me in my formative years, I'm glad. You know, I read all the kinds of things that people read back. I loved P.G. Woodhouse just because it's a brilliant performance, and it doesn't have to be about anything. So it's the pure delight of language and plot and character, and the fact that it isn't about anything except its own world is lovely. And then I like, which is the kind of deeper version of Woodhouse, for example. I like Evelyn Waugh. I was sort of laid up for a day or two, and I reread Handful of Dust, which is just a marvelous work. And it starts off shallow and superficial, and it just grows deeper and deeper and deeper. And I love that. I love that novel, and I reread it. I reread that every few years. And I think I read it in the sort of wake of Brexit and all that, because it seemed pertinent, as it always does for me. But I can't. I'm not sure I could list every single writer who had an impact on me in my formative years, as it were. I do think you should all. I do think it helps to always read a stage above, and that's why I get a bit worried about all this young adult fiction and young teen fiction. Because I sort of think when you are 13 or 14, you should be trying to read grown-up books, even if you don't quite get all the grown-up elements of them. Anyway, that's my view on that. Todd Lewis writes, is Mitt Romney indicative of an ecological crisis? He's one of the last of a species called the white rhino that used to roam the savannas of state capitals and Washington, D.C. in fairly large numbers. The powdered horns of these creatures were said to be an aphrodisiac to young lawyers aspiring to a career in politics. Voters who came of age in the era of Trump may not be that familiar with these creatures. Mitt may be one of the few remaining examples of what these beasts looked like, how they sounded, and what their behavior patterns were. Young people should know that these were dangerous animals that did not benefit the ecosystem. Should the white rhino be allowed to become extinct? Or do we still need them? I don't think they're as extinct as you think they are, actually, Todd. For the first 2 years of the Trump administration, we didn't really make the progress that Trump supporters might have expected, in part because the so-called party of the White House was also the so-called party of Congress. The Republicans controlled everything, the presidency, the House of Representatives, the Senate. But in the House particularly, Paul Ryan, I do believe, and this is not, I don't think he would actually in his more honest moments dispute this. Paul Ryan was not a Trump supporter. And in fact, after the bit about the tape about grabbing feline creatures was released, he was someone who, I believe, in a conference call said that voters shouldn't vote for Trump, and what mattered now was to try and save the House majority and everything. So he was never a Trump guy. He's not a Trump guy on the issues. It's not just that he doesn't like the grabbing tape. He doesn't believe in the wall. So he didn't do anything, and he objectively obstructed a lot. And I think that strain of Republican is still there. They've gone quiet for a moment, except for Mitt, because they seem to think, and Mitt is in an unusual position because he tried for the big prize and he flopped. And so he knows he's not going to come again, his moment. So what's the role that you want to carve out for yourself then? Is it just going to be lobby fodder for Trumpism, where you just meekly troop into the yes vote lobby and pull the lever for Trump? Or is the more appealing and distinctive niche to be the John McCain figure, the maverick, the one you can whose vote you can never quite tell which way it's going to go. He's neither as smart nor as mean as McCain, so he's not going to play that role terribly well. And I would imagine but the important point remains, Todd. The white rhino, as you call it, is not quite as extinct as you might think. Josh Passel writes, I turn on my microwave to heat milk for my coffee, and Mitt Romney came on to explain how God made him vote to convict. The guy's everywhere. God, of course, but I mean Romney. A more cynical person than I might wonder if it's all a PR ploy, but even Candy Crowley's whipping boy can't be so craven to seek approval from the likes of Morning Joe and the twin Chrises, Matthews and Cuomo. What happened to the corporate raider, Mitt Romney, who single-handedly killed the steelworker's wife by cancelling his health insurance? That Mitt was meaner than a junkyard dog. This Mitt is so whiny, I want to strap him to the roof of Thelma and Louise's car. You love him so much, Progs, he's all yours. At least he doesn't sniff ladies' hair. You know, it's not inconceivable that at some point, probably shortly after the New Hampshire vote on Tuesday, that there will be some of Mitt's Democrat friends going to see him and attempting to persuade him to enter the Democrat nominating process. He's vain enough. He thinks he the thing about it is, nobody, that thing he did last time round where he said Trump was unfit to be president. There's people who can go and do what he did and just give a speech and explain, but not the guy who screwed up so badly last time. I had a conversation with Mitt. I would say this was a couple of, not long, actually, maybe, you know, a couple of months after the, and actually, I believe before the second Obama inaugural. So we're talking late 2012 or January 2013, after he'd lost. And he called up because he wanted to invite me to something that he was hosting in Utah, a big bipartisan conference to save America. And I was thinking that this was ridiculous. It was completely ridiculous because the guy who just lost the election can't credibly hold that. You've offered your vision of the people to the people, and the people have said up yours. You're the one person who can't host that. And Mitt said something to me very interesting that he'd expected to. We were just chit-chatting before we got down to the nuts, and he wanted me to come out to whatever it was, the Marriott or the Ritz-Carlton somewhere in Utah, and take part in this conference. And Mitt said to me something very revealing just in the first couple of minutes while we were doing all the, how are you, how's things, how's it going? And he said he had actually expected to win on that night. And I hadn't, not after the Candy Crowley moment, because he failed to close the deal. And Mitt, and I have no reason to doubt his sincerity on this, he actually thought he was going to win. He actually thought he was going to win. And, you know, that's sad. And it suggests a lack of, you know, someone should be self-aware enough to realize that after that performance, that underperformance, he can't be the alternative to Trump or to Obama or to anything. He had his chance and he blew it. Laura Rosen-Cohen says, hi, Mark, if memory serves, you called Mitt Romney a contemptible husk of a man on Rush earlier this week. Did I? Oh, dear. I was thinking about his disgusting, pitiful, self-serving homily, and it occurred to me that he was just looking for redemption from the kook left. I used to think that identity politics was religion without redemption, but now I realize that non-leftists can find redemption by recanting their principles and taking an oath to the left. Do you think Utah voters will actually succeed in recalling him? Was the media slobberfest really worth it? It seems a very silly price to pay for selling one's soul. That's a very interesting point, Laura. Identity politics is religion without redemption. except if you're on the right. And on the right, you can be a sexist, racist, tax cheat, as they insisted that Mitt was in 2012. And all you got to do is go over to the left and suddenly you're the greatest thing ever. That's happened to all kinds of people who've fallen out with Trump, and there's no reason why Mitt shouldn't avail himself of that. And conversely, on the other side, if you're a leftist, you don't need redemption. Nobody has to. The Virginia governor, he doesn't have to be forgiven for wearing blackface. Justin Trudeau doesn't have to be forgiven for wearing blackface, black arms, black legs, black torso, and a banana down his pants because he's Justin Trudeau. So this is. They try to make it about other things, but in the end, it's just about power. It's as naked as that. Justin Trudeau can wear blackface. Mitt Romney can't. So Justin Trudeau doesn't need redemption, and Mitt Romney can only earn redemption by urinating all over the right. Diana Pollan says, come to think of it, I'd hesitate to vote for a guy who straps his dog to the roof before taking the wheel. Oh, a lot of dogs enjoy it. I used to, before New Hampshire became such a sissy boy state, dogs used to see a lot more dogs in pickups. The dogs loved just standing in the bed of a pickup, leaning out into the wind. So there are dogs who do enjoy it. I don't know whether, you know, certain kind of dog. I have no idea what kind of dog he had up on the roof. I could probably look it up. Don't know whether it was a Shih Tzu or something, or a Weimarana. Might be one of these highly strung dogs that doesn't care for it. But some dogs actually do like being in a vehicle at speed in the open air. So the problem with that, of course, Diana, was that he was driving his dog to Canada. And no self-respecting American dog wants to be driven to Canada. That's really where the media had him banged to rights. Victor Selby says, now that impeachment has flopped and the Democrats are ordering their "we impeach the president" and all we got was some lousy pens and Mitt Romney t-shirts, is there any sense they're going to try again? If they manage to hold the House, is it going to be a la Jacques Parizeau on Quebec independence votes, a trip to the impeachment dentist every few months? Well, I think I called it on Tucker. I was interviewing, I think it might have been Matt Gaetz or some congressman. I think I called it the impeachment of the month club just after this first one got going. Yeah, they will. Well, you should be so lucky, Jacques Parizeau. Say what you like about the Quebecers. They had an independence referendum in 1980 and then another one 15 years later. And they haven't had one in the quarter century since. They talk about it occasionally. And for a while on Anglo radio in Montreal, they used to call it the never-endum, in that they'd always be threatening it. But in the end, they only held two, 1980 and 1995. These guys are going to impeach. They think everyone else is as poisoned. I used the phrase tertiary syphilis, because that's what it is. When it's eaten away everything in you and you become a zombie. These guys, Nadler and Schiff, are zombies staggering. They were now already talking about issuing a subpoena to John Bolton. Subpoena, why don't you issue 1,000 subpoenas? Hold investigations until the end of time. You've killed your own primary. No one's enthused. There's no end. You look at the ratings on Fox right now are phenomenal. Whatever it was, I was impressed. You know, we were, when I was on with Tucker, whatever it was, 4.5 million, I think it was. Went up to 5 point something million on Tucker the other night, because basically this nuisance litigation has enthused Trump's base, and the Democrat base is entirely indifferent to it. The numbers for Iowa, 170,000 people, no enthusiasm. That's terrible. Voted in the Iowa caucus. You got all these exciting candidates, gay guys, women. Nobody's interested. Nobody's interested, because what you did with impeachment, you stopped talking about the future. You stopped talking about any vision. You stop talking about anything that matters to anyone who can cast a vote in November. And instead you're just interviewing, holding sessions with slightly weird and off people, bow-tied twits from the State Department who seem to think that because they're, quote, career public servants, unquote, that they're entitled to set policy and the voters don't actually matter. Well, the Democrats have taken you at your word there. They didn't turn out in Iowa. And you were reduced. You were reduced to actually, instead of, you know, Putin at least interferes supposedly in foreign elections, you guys have so screwed things up, you're reduced to interfering in your own primary. How desperate is that? You have to fix your own, you never mind before we get to November, you got to fix your own primary because your own voters aren't doing as you're told, as they're told. So the Democrats would be very lucky if they turned Jacques Parizeau and just pulled this garbage once every 15 years. They're going to impeach him again because it's all they know how, and they're obsessed with him. And if you think about it from their point of view, that November 2016 shouldn't have happened, and so reversing November 2016 will be their priority, always be their priority, and they'll take anything to hand. It doesn't matter whether it's Russia, doesn't matter whether it's Stormy Daniels, doesn't matter whether it's Ukraine, they'll use whatever's to hand. They're that, and their base isn't interested. I keep saying this. If you talk to their base, the base wants policies. Now, you can say they want insane policies like socialist healthcare and open borders, but it's the policies. They're not. This is just some beltway game. Apart from a certain kind of celebrity who's on Twitter too much, like Bette Midler, and the reason they do that is because they're offended as celebrities, because Bette Midler thought of herself as an A-list celebrity, and when Trump was doing his TV show, she thought of Trump as a Z-list celebrity. So the idea that the Z-list celebrity is now the leader of the free world offends Bette Midler's sense of herself. But if it, except for the freaks in Congress, the media, and various celebrities who are on Twitter too long, plus the Antifa mob in the street, most of the Democrats' voters aren't interested in any of this at all. As Janet Long says, here we go, this makes the point. Mark, I have every faith that President Trump will be re-elected and Republicans will own Congress again. If we cannot take the House back, articles of impeachment will be introduced immediately, and here we go again. Other than never allowing a Democrat into a position of power again, what can be done about their never-ending quest to punish Mr. Trump for daring to be elected twice? Well now, Janet, this is the key here. I think to a certain extent, Trump is in a... nobody knows what will happen. I mean, Kim Jong-un might manage actually to fire a missile and hit his intended target for the first time ever. You never know. This coronavirus, for example, the Chinese have obviously been lying about it, and it's obviously far more widespread in China than the Chinese are admitting, and therefore it's already seeped beyond China's borders to a degree that they have misled us about. So if the coronavirus wipes out a third of Earth's population and Trump has his equivalent of the heck of a job brownie moment that Bush had, who knows what will happen? I mean, nobody knows. Events, dear boy, events, as Harold Macmillan liked to say in the old cliche British politics. But absent that I think Trump is in a pretty sweet spot right now. And the energy... it's important to actually hold the Senate. Now, they think that ghastly guy, who's the guy, what's he called, Stephen Colbert, called Susan Collins a skin bag, is that right? I don't really know what he's talking about there. But anyway, he seemed to be insulting her physical appearance and mocking her tremulous manner of speaking, which is the sort of thing these civilized, liberal, progressive, sensitive, new age men seem to like to do. He's got the same kind of sensitivity that Harvey Weinstein might if he met Susan Collins in a bar late at night. I don't know what why he thought that was funny, but he said she's going to be the former senator from Maine. I don't know. I don't think anybody in Maine cares about is going to vote on impeachment. They're going to vote on the economy. They're going to vote on policies. And the old line that when in a second term election, that it's a referendum on the incumbent president. The Democrats have gone too far with that. It's not a lot of the stuff that they think is terrible about Trump, like the guy, like Nancy Pelosi saying he appears to be on drugs and all this kind of thing. And that idiot at CNN, Harwood, is that his name, John Harwood? I don't know him, except he made some snide crack about me a few years ago. I can't even remember what the crack was. They're not very good at cracks, really. But he was talking about how Trump's performance was disturbing psychologically. There's people who like Trump, and then there's people who hate Trump. But the people who hate Trump are a much smaller sliver than the people who like Trump. And in between are a lot of people who are kind of indifferent to Trump, but very happy with the economy and other issues and don't want to jeopardize that to take a wild flyer on some of the crazy stuff the Democrats are proposing. Richard Malaby writes, "Hello, Mark. As always, love the club, the place where everybody knows my name. Two things. When Pelosi comes out and claims Trump will be impeached forever and Schumer states we always knew we would not be able to convict, doesn't that give the game away that this was nothing more than an attempt to stall Trump's agenda? Further, if I take you to court on account of some sensational accusation and you are found to be innocent and I come out and say, Mark will be accused of this crime forever, but I always knew we could not convict him, isn't that textbook malicious prosecution? Actually, yes, indeed it is. I don't know whether it's true in every jurisdiction, but I did look into this at the time, going back to that Cockwomble Cats and CRTV and all that nonsense. And losing the second suit against me, we did look into actually suing him and his guys for malicious prosecution and actually getting... Nancy Pelosi the other day wanted Trump's lawyers disbarred, which is a truly, as Alan Dershowitz says, is a truly McCarthyite thing. But actually, lawyers, speaking of her lawyers, the House managers, lawyers who prosecute a case they know they can't win, in other words, that they know has no chance of winning, that it's not a good faith prosecution. That's actually one thing we were going to sue the Katz guys over at one point, because in certain jurisdictions, that is actually one of the definitions of a malicious prosecution. You know you can't win it, but you're just trying to tie the guy up. Now, obviously, in this case, it's all politics, so that probably doesn't count. But that is a good point, Richard. Richard also adds, I realize the State of the Union is always heavy on the rah-rah stuff, but with the Democrats bashing the speech unanimously while some of their stars opted not to attend, it got me thinking, I have plenty of liberal friends who can't stand Trump, think he's a threat to the country, blah, blah. But when you actually listen to the guy, he's put together an impressive list of pro-American accomplishments. I think it's fine when individuals tune out the president or do not pay attention to politics. But I think it's unhealthy when the Democrat Party and the media project their ignorance on half the country. The interesting thing about that, I don't know who watches the State of the Union these days. I believe it's still carried on the terrestrial channels, the broadcast networks, your ABCs and CBS and NBC. I don't know who watches it, how many people watch it, though. But I think what they would have seen, unless you are as deranged about Trump as the average CNN or MSNBC anchor, Trump was the least weird thing in that room the other night. You know, Nancy Pelosi doing that sourpuss face and tearing up her papers, tearing up her copy of the speech, the Grim Ripper, as Trump called her, and sitting on there. Well, and then all those Handmaid's Tale women in their identikit white, sitting in there looking like the choir at a rather tacky, and dubious televangelist church. It wasn't a good look on them. And Nadler and Schiff sitting together, the House impeachment guys all sitting together, just because they wanted to rub it in Trump's face that you're still not acquitted yet, looking like a bunch of seedy losers, sitting on their hands for the victims of illegal immigration, the victims of Soleimani, the victims of Baghdadi, sitting on their hands when an African-American girl has the opportunity to get out of her dysfunctional public school and get an education, sitting on their hands for the young child who was born at 21 weeks old because of the new technology that now makes younger and younger babies deliverable. It wasn't a good look. And they were the weirder ones. They were the weirder ones. And Trump just seemed very businesslike. That's just not a good look for them. We're over our time. Let's take one more question, shall we? Timothy McDonnell says, today, February 7th, marks the sad 35th year anniversary of the far too early death of Britain's greatest singer of the standards, the man with the golden voice, Matt Monro. I'm a huge fan of his creamy baritone, and I never tire of that voice. I listen to him every day. The day before he died, as he lay in his bed at the Cromwell Hospital in London, he received a telegram from Frank Sinatra wishing him well. It meant a lot to him, as he considered Sinatra the greatest interpreter of popular music, and I agree. Sadly, he also had never met Sinatra, although Monro was good friends with Sammy Davis Jr., as Don Black was his longtime manager and sometime lyricist. That's right, Don wrote Walk Away, If I Never Sing Another Song, Born Free, For Mama, On Days Like These, and Timothy throws in a lesser-known but personal favourite of his, Loving You Again. I was wondering if you have ever spoken with him in depth about his time working with Matt Monro. It would make for some great songs of the week for you, I'm sure. If you haven't, perhaps today would be a good day to call and reminisce. Enjoy all of his justly noted classic name-dropping. Matt Monro is a great singer, and you know who he was the favourite singer of? I told Don this. We haven't, you don't normally have big... I don't think I've ever had a really big in-depth conversation with Don specifically about Matt Monro, where we, started talking about Matt over the soup and went all the way to the brandy and cigars. But Matt was the favourite singer of Karen Carpenter. Karen's brother, Richard Carpenter, told me that. And the minute you're told that, and you then listen to Karen Carpenter's voice, and you listen to a Matt Monro record, you can actually, you'll understand why Karen liked Matt Monro, and why he was her favorite singer. So no argument from me on that, Timothy. There's one thing he did, and I said this to Don. So, it's in his recording of "Come Back to Me," which he does in waltz time, which I don't particularly like. Mademoiselle, where in hell can you be? And he was uncomfortable singing the word hell, as people were in those days. Seems ridiculous now. But he said, Mademoiselle, he sang Mademoiselle, where on earth can you be? And of course, earth doesn't rhyme with the zeal of Mademoiselle. And that annoyed me. That annoyed me for a bit. And if you get over things like that, things like, if I never sing another song, which is one of Don's greatest songs, and Shirley Bassey and people have sung it, but it's one of those songs that I think actually... it requires a man to sing, and it is such a great thing about the vicissitudes of the performing life. It's a great thing. Thank you very much for that question. Matt, if you like Matt Munro, Don has a show on the BBC, BBC Radio 2, Sunday nights, and he always plays a track by what he calls the matchless Matt Munro. And maybe Don and I will sit down and do a whole thing on Matt Munro one of these days. And I do remember how touched he was. I think David Jacobs, another colossus of the Beeb, told me this, how touched he was on that day, the final hours of his life, to receive a telegram from Frank Sinatra. I'll tell you one more question. Thomas Shepstone says, I'll do two more questions. Toby Pilling says, Boris Johnson seems intent on prostrating himself before the green goddess, Greta Thunberg. Why are a nominally conservative administration so keen on ruining the economy in pursuit of chimerical carbon emission targets? Boris is full of it on the climate. He doesn't mean a word of it. I had lunch with him years ago. He thought the climate change thing was all total bollocks then. He doesn't get it now. To get it would require him to... I just don't think it's a... resisting climate change isn't a priority for him. Brexit and a post-Brexit Britain are the thing. But whatever Boris says to you in public about climate change, you can rest assured, take it from me, he said to me very persuasively, he regarded the whole thing... I probably shouldn't say this, but he said to me over lunch, it's all bollocks, and he has no idea... why it's just caught on with the frenzy it has. So don't worry. He is a liberal Tory. But if you think it's going to be wind turbines from sea to shining sea, I don't think it is. Unless he's going to put wind turbines along the Irish border to blow over the backstop. That would be a useful thing. Anyway, Thomas Shepson says, finally, does Brexit really happening mean the voices of rural Britannia are finally being heard by those who have sung them so beautifully for years at the conclusion of the proms? Has the British establishment realised they were becoming slaves? The establishment hasn't. They're like the court eunuchs. They're happy to grease up to the masters of the slaves in Brussels. But there is something stirring about those words. And the rule Britannia is one of those things where they try to pretend that it's a kind of postmodern parodic patriotism. It was our song of the week this week, and do click onto it because there's I love Dame Kiri Te Kanawa's version, New Zealand's finest, and everyone down in New Zealand listening to this on a Saturday morning or Saturday lunchtime or Saturday evening or whatever it is by now. Dame Kiri's version is a absolute corker, but they've tried to pretend it's sort of semi-parodic, postmodern version of patriotism. It's not. The people who sing that sing it and mean it. And the question is, as I said when we wrote about it, does Britain mean it? Rule Britannia. Britain's self-rule Britannia. Rule yourself. Govern yourself. Don't be ruled by Brussels bureaucrats, because then you are slaves. Thank you for all your questions. And on that stirring note, that is it for us. We shall see you next time.